Welcome to the Thinklings Podcast, a conversation where good thoughts help renew the mind with the Word of God. I'm Charlie Carter, and I'm here with Tim Little and Andy Stearns. Let's jump into the conversation. Good morning, gentlemen and listener. Welcome to the Thinklings Podcast.
Shalom.
Good morning.
Shalom. Greatly excellent morning to thee.
Yes. So we're going to start our episode with a rousing game of... What kind of coffee are we drinking?
That's right. Boy. And since I brought it, I'm not going to guess. So it's you three. Josh is bowing out, it sounds like, because you have the other kind.
I have no knowledge. I mean,
it's definitely a light roast.
Definitely. You are correct. Yep. It is a light roast.
Yep. I'm thinking maybe something from Kazakhstan.
You know, you're horrendous. Close, Josh. You have no idea.
Mm. It's got a different taste for sure.
Do you want the flavor tasting notes from the bag?
Mm-mm.
You don't even want that? Okay. Because I didn't know.
I have no idea.
If there's flavor tasting notes, then it makes it nothing impossible. Okay.
It's, I would just say it has a very bright first taste.
Okay.
And I don't know how to describe kind of that second wave that hits okay. you.
What side of the globe do you think you're on?
Oh, I think it's African.
Okay.
That's what I was going to say.
There we go.
So if I say that, and we're wrong, then none of us have a shot.
That's okay. It can be that way.
I'm tasting something strongly former USSR.
Listener, Josh is not even drinking this cup.
Is this a Norway blend? Or is this a
you
Ukraine?
Guys are horrendous.
Are we in NATO
What's
here?
Your official, unofficial guess, Charlie?
I'll say it's in Africa.
Okay. It is a Guatemalan.
Oh, boom. Wow. Okay.
There it is. Yeah, and here's the thing. So it's the Finca Pensamiento from Hardy Coffee Co. in Omaha. So I was in Omaha a couple weeks ago, and it was really good coffee. And so I got a 5-pound bag for really good price. Nice. So I'll be drinking this for a while. But it is Guatemalan, and its flavor notes are golden apple, cider, caramel, and milk chocolate, which I think it's like they're sweet and not so sweet. Mm-hmm. So that makes it hard to taste. It's pretty good. Ooh. I wouldn't say it's my favorite I've ever had. It's not like that Kenyan. That stuff's really good.
Awesome. And we have an email.
Oh, yeah. Riley Peake wrote in a while ago, and he is writing, and it was really encouraging to get an email from you, Riley. Thanks for writing in and letting us know about a book that you've been writing, and that the Thinklings have just been encouraging you in your writing endeavors. So, hey, if you're a listener out there and you're working on writing, you know, we can't read everything that's written and that you guys write, but we appreciate hearing from you. So write in and let us know. Thanks a lot.
That's fantastic. Wouldn't it be cool if there was a writing renaissance, partly because of us? That would be great.
Yes.
People just start writing stories and good books. And
that was a yes or no question, correct?
Yes.
Yes. Yes. That would be great.
It does assume that there was writing beforehand, though, if it's a rebirth or a renaissance.
That's true. Well, maybe. There is writing currently, just more writing. Okay, and a writing increase? A writing crescendo?
Books and business.
Let's talk about some books.
All right, well, I'll go first, right?
Man, that was a hard transition.
It was a hard transition. Tim didn't give us any warning, but he was done. He was done with the nonsense.
Yes.
And I blame Kazakhstan. Okay.
If I could describe Tim in one way, I would say no nonsense.
No nonsense. That's right. There's no nonsense. I'm listening to Instruments of the Redeemer's Hand on my way to work. I'm trying to listen through all my counseling books from the past, and it's been a really good book with a lot of good reminders. So I'm just highlighting this, listener. If you've never read Tripp's Instruments in the Redeemer's Hands, you should pick it up and read it. I'll just read a quick quote. There's a story of a guy who meets sort of a guy who's down and out, and he brings him back to his house, and he sets him on the couch, and he calls his pastor, who's Paul Tripp, and he's like, "Hey, pastor, God put this guy in my life, in my path today, and I helped him, and I knew that if I got him to you, you'd be able to help him." And Tripp's like, "Man, I am so glad that in God's sovereignty, he's brought him to your house, and I am confident that the Lord will be able to help you help him." And so he walked with the guy, and the guy ended up helping, but he said, the problem is that most of us think we go to the pastor for all that kind of professional stuff. So he says this is the quote. "The problem is that most of us think that God is carrying around a very small toolbox. A successful carpenter uses many tools, each one designed for a particular job. God has a huge toolbox, and his principal tools are his children. Sadly, Many people in the church do not see themselves this way. They think of ministry as something for the paid professional. When they think of their own involvement, they don't think very far beyond saying a prayer or making a meal. Yet their adoption into the family of God was also a call to ministry, a call to be part of the good work. And I cut it short there for obvious reasons, but yeah, it's a good quote. So recommend the book if you haven't read it.
It is a very good book.
It's a classic.
So there's some content coming in the future on our podcast that I don't think anything has gone out with yet, but doing some study on German Baptist Brethren.
That is such a great line right yep. there. German Baptist Brethren.
So the book I have here is A History of German Baptist Brethren in Europe and America. And it's a very poor Kindle edition because it's scans, PDF scans of the book. The reason being that it's probably not a wildly popular read. It was published by Martin, I think his name would be Brumba, in 1899. So it's very old.
Wow.
And I have just a quote, and it is the opening line that has nothing to do with Germans, Baptists, or Brethrens, but it's a really catchy opening line. So, to write the history of a religious movement, oh wait, is this the right quote? Nope, that's the introduction. Let's get to the preface. That's where we want. There we go.
It's a wonky Kindle ebook.
It is wonky.
History at best is a beggarly gleaner in a field where death has gathered a bountiful harvest. I'll read that again. History at best is a beggarly gleaner in a field where death has gathered a bountiful harvest.
Oh my, that is so good.
That is good.
Excuse me? So I was not expecting much, but this is like one of the only scholarly published works that I could dredge up about this very specific time period and group of people. And man, was I not expecting that opening line.
That is fantastic.
That did things in me when I read that. That's a bit of good writing.
If as teachers, we still carried our teaching notes in D-ring binders and you put like a cover page on, that would be on my Western Civ 1 and 2. But it is currently going in my quotables.
Yeah, it's a very, very high quality quote. But it's also, as I've delved into it, it's been very helpful to understand what I'm trying to study and the people and how they interact. And so we'll get more of that in a future episode. But yeah, history at best is a beggarly gleaner in a field where death has gathered a bountiful harvest.
So my book is Made to Be She, Reclaiming God's Plan for Fearless Femininity by Kristen Clark and Bethany Beal. I talked about recovering from purity culture a few weeks ago. That book was written by published by Baker Books, and this one is as well. These books are basically two sides of the debate, so to speak, about femininity and purity culture. Kristen Clark and Bethany Beal both are more complementarian, and then the other book was egalitarian, which gives you a little bit of idea of just where Baker Books and a lot of these publishers are at. They're basically publishing books that are on both sides of the conversation, so they don't really care.
Is that like when America sells arms to both sides of a conflict?
Yeah, something like that. Okay. Mm-hmm. So the book is, I would say, pretty good. The first chapter is Seduced by a Cosmo Girl, which was kind of fascinating. They said that the Cosmopolitan magazine, it's a horrendous magazine that's been out for a very long time. And basically they admitted to making up these stories of this sexualized woman enjoying life. And so it's just kind of fascinating that, you know, they created this idea of a woman that is contrary to reality, and they knew that. So that was the first chapter. Second chapter, The Ditch of Feminist Womanhood. And then the third chapter is The Ditch of Religious Womanhood. So, of course, they're looking at, oh, you got to balance these things out. And it's not really a balance. And I can't remember if they even use that word, but there's feminism on one side, and you don't want to go into that ditch. And then there's this religious womanhood on the other side. I'm not a big fan of this religiosity speech, because generally I think it's just somebody's trying to live a faith-filled life that is absent of worldliness. And people don't define their terms well, but in this book, they actually just admitted that it critiques purity culture a fair amount, and at least their experience with purity culture was legalistic. And I think that they actually got that term right in this chapter. So, hey, if that was their experience and they're saying, hey, don't fall into this ditch, then I didn't really have a problem with it. So those are the two ditches. And then they go through and they start to craft a biblical femininity, which I didn't read all of it, but some of the things that they hit on, I thought were really good. For example, rejecting weak and wimpy womanhood and encouraging women to be students of the word. So they go through like some Bible study principles and stuff, and made to be he and she. So there's a difference between the genders, and the book kind of goes on from there. So it's a new book, Made to Be She by Kristen Clark and Bethany Beal. I'm not sure how wholly, I think I'm done with it. It's a book that I don't have a problem selling in the bookstore, and I was just kind of figuring that part of it out. But I think I could give a decent recommendation to it. So that's it.
My book is Seeing Beauty and Saying Beautifully, The Power of Poetic Effort in the Work of George Herbert, George Whitfield, and C.S. Lewis by John Piper. And I picked this book up because I have a lot of interest in George Herbert in particular. I teach his poetry in my courses, and I've been wanting to read this one for a while. And I want to just share a quotation from this work. It's in the introduction, and Piper is wrestling with this idea of eloquence. And as Christians, sometimes we find ourselves reluctant to be eloquent because we don't want to merely be persuasive with the words that we're using. And so that's what he's wrestling with in the introduction, but he's making the case that there's arguments for pursuing poetic effort or saying things well. And one of those reasons is saying newly is a way of seeing and savoring newly. And he focuses on George Herbert here. And it's poetic effort as fellowship with Christ. In his poem called Quiddity, George Herbert has these lines about what writing poetry is for him. And this is part of the poem. It is no office, art, or news, nor the exchange or busy hall, but it is that which while I use, I am with thee. His poems are that which while I use, I am with thee. This put into words what I have found to be true for decades, the effort to put the truth of God and all his ways and works into fresh language, something that may have never been spoken before, is a way of coming near to God because of seeing and feeling more suitably. Herbert confirmed for me in his experience what has been an indispensable part of my preaching and writing. I don't mean just the writing of poems, but also the writing of sermons and books and letters and most anything else that matters. Every sermon was an opportunity not just to say, but to see and savor. Every effort to speak the wonders of the Word of God became a fresh seeing and a fresh savoring. The pressure to prepare a fresh word from God week by week was one of the greatest gifts of my life. The effort to say beautifully was a way of seeing beautifully. The effort to put a glimpse of glory into striking or moving words made the glimpse grow. The effort to find worthy words for Christ opened to me more fully the worth of Christ. I think this is true for everyone, and that is one of the reasons I have written this book.
That is nice.
Yeah, it's a... I haven't gotten too far into it yet, but I've been doing it so far.
That gets into a conversation that I still don't know if I've come solely down onto a conclusion, because Paul writes about how he doesn't want to come with eloquence to the Corinthians. But then at the same time, you have within the Old Testament the prophets, and they are communicating eloquently. They are seeking to persuade. I've kind of just concluded, you know, there's a time and a place for both. And in some instances, and usually we should seek to persuade, seek to be eloquent. But there is a time and a situation where it's like, listen, you're just seeing if I can persuade you. This is not the case here. But anyway,
And he deals with those passages in the introduction and kind of walks through them. And this is a concern that comes up a lot in the courses I teach. I teach Introduction to Communication, which is a public speaking course, and students often ask this very question. So it's helpful. The introduction is very helpful for that.
Not to belabor the conversation. So the sophists, or the sophists, whatever, they didn't care who they were selling for. They would try to persuade whatever and get money off of it. Is he mentioned that? And then does he say that Paul was not saying, Paul's not opposed to beauty and persuasive, but in his world, he's trying to pull himself away from those sophists or whatever, the salesmen who were just using eloquent speech?
Is that right? Yeah, he does. Okay. He does get into that.
Okay. I was just curious. Yeah, I feel like we could have a whole podcast episode on that right now, but let's not do that.
Yeah. So what's coming up in this episode is a conversation about godliness. It's part two of Andy's series. Mm-hmm. So we hope you enjoy that and we'll see you next week.
Let's have a conversation about godliness. So in the study of godliness that we started a couple of weeks back, I had said I had six verses that I thought all were paths that lead to godliness. I had been having my devotions, and in Titus 1, it talks about the knowledge that leads to godliness, and there's different translations. So if you remember that, we talked about that. And then we decided to look at the first of those verses and talk quite a bit about it. Today, I'm going to take the path analogy and adjust it. And so I'm going to say that this is a path that leads to discernment, or leads to godliness. And it's going to be two of the verses, and I'm going to call it the path of discernment. So the first verse we're going to discuss is 2 Timothy 3:4. And I'm going to say that the command there is to avoid the wrong friendships. When you avoid the wrong friendships, it will lead you to godliness. The second verse we're going to talk about today is back in 1 Timothy chapter 6, verse 11, where it will actually just say, pursue godliness. And so why am I using the word discernment? So when we think of discernment, we think of distinguishing between right and wrong and good and evil. And so if you're distinguishing between something good and something evil, then by doing that, you necessarily know I need to avoid the evil thing and I need to follow after the good thing. That's part of like Psalm 1, Proverbs 1, the whole book. So since I have two verses that are paired, and one is going to say something to avoid, and one is going to say something to pursue, just thematically, I'm going to use the word discernment. And so this is going to be a type of discernment by pairing these two that will help you to land in godliness if you follow this path. Okay, now that's a little artificial, listeners, just a thematic way to arrange it. So the first verse that we're going to talk about is 2 Timothy 3:4, and I'm going to read... maybe I'll see if someone else wants to read the five verses. Charlie, you want to read 1 through 5 for us?
2 Timothy 3, 1 through 5, and I am reading ESV. Is that okay?
Yep.
Okay. But understand this, that in the last days there will come times of difficulty. For people will be lovers of self, lovers of money, proud, arrogant, abusive, disobedient to their parents, ungrateful, unholy, heartless, unappeasable, slanderous, without self-control, brutal, not loving good, verse 4, treacherous, reckless, swollen with conceit, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God, having the appearance of godliness but denying its power. Avoid such people.
Thank you very much. So here we have a context of really, really bad times. People, the culture's getting bad. In fact, it's really interesting if someone wrote a blog post and said that, hey, the times today have just gotten really bad. People love themselves and they love their money and they're proud. And you wrote this and I'd never read the Bible, I would just think someone's writing about today. And I think that just shows how the Bible rightly sees, assesses, and understands culture. And so here, there's a whole list of ways that people have turned away from the truth, and then it's both things that they love that are wrong things to love, and then behaviors that they live out that are wrong types of behavior. There's an analysis and an assessment at the end of these people. It says they have become, at the end of verse 4, it says, it's sort of like a final, there's a couple of lovers of, and then it's a bunch of behaviors, and then it's lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God. And then there's this analysis of these people having the appearance of godliness, but denying its power. So if you had not included that last line and a half that I just read, I would have assumed this is talking about pagan unbelievers. But how do you have an appearance of godliness and deny its power? I wonder, but I haven't studied this part out yet. I wonder if this is really talking about people in the church. And so I'm going to hold that because I haven't looked that up historically. But at the very least, there are people who would claim to be Christians and in some way would have an appearance of like, man, they're godly. But what's the power of godliness? What is what is the power that leads to godliness actually do to a person?
It's the Spirit of God at work in their life. So that internal source of power. I feel like sometimes it's like the Stoicism or even the wrong kind of, you know, legalism.
Where yeah.
They're like yes. buffeting the body. Yep. They're living presumably in a godly way, but internally they're just rotten to the core.
Yeah, I think too, the cultural aspect is interesting because most of the Greek culture, and you could maybe even sprinkle in some Roman ideas too, but mostly the Greek, you think about how a lot of their gods, plural, would have been highlighting a very quote unquote ungodly lifestyle. So you could be a pagan worshiper and you're doing what worship, you know, in italics, worship you're supposed to. So a form of godliness, but there's no real power over sin. You know, it's a godliness that exists in hedonism and pleasure. So I think that could be a part of it, but if we're going to bring that context into the church, people who do the right things and follow the rules, so to speak, but they're not genuinely pious. They're not righteous. They're not holy.
Almost like they're a whitewashed tomb.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was totally thinking of like the Pharisees.
And so what I would say, if you have in your list, and I would say this to the listener, but I would say it to myself too, because I've been there. If you have a time in life where you're trying to follow the Lord and you're even engaging maybe in some sort of a ministry, but then what people don't see isn't changing, then there is a form of external appearance of godliness. But there is some aspect where the power is not functional. I would be careful because there's also sanctification where we are growing in this area and we're still not growing here. And so I don't want any listener to hear this and think, oh man, I have one aspect of sin. I'm a pagan. But what if the way you're going about changing your life and trying to follow the Lord, you've been doing it carefully, but then you don't have the fruit of the Spirit being exhibited in your life. You're not walking according to the Spirit, probably. So what I liked about this is because usually, I remember one time in life being sinned against by a person, and the sin was deception, it was manipulation, it was a whole bunch of bad things, but it was someone who I went to church with. And I remember thinking, huh? And it helped me to see that believers sin, and it's not always the unbeliever who's the enemy. The believer's not the enemy, but like they can sin too, and they can sin grievously because we're all growing.
Or they're not a believer.
Well, that's the other thing, and I'm not opposed to that. In this case, I don't know. I think probably not, probably very, very, been a Christian a long time, very, very immature. Don't think there's any awareness of how to be sanctified, but I do think there's enough in this person's life. And so I think they probably are regenerate. They're just really grieving the Spirit maybe, but I would also be open that maybe they're not.
The imperative at the end of your text too, avoid such people.
Well, and that's where we're going. But the one thing I want to say is, here's what I would say. I don't know if they're saved or not. but, and I think this is appropriate because of the way they're living, I don't have evidence that they are. They might be, but also not. And I think we can be like, well, how can we know? I'm like, well, that's actually the problem of not walking in the Spirit is you don't know. And it's not that you've lost your salvation, but the Spirit is not going to assure you if you're living in sin. So, yes, the imperative at the end now is when you find people like this, avoid them. And so here's the little mini discussion here. Paul warns Timothy to avoid these people who appear godly, but deny its power. And so I looked up, you know, avoid. We know what that means, but I thought, well, let me just look up the Greek word, make sure it's not something hidden there. And there's not. Okay, this is the definition. No, I just, sometimes I think That's people good. Think if we just knew the Greek word, I'm like,
it'll change everything.
No, we translated the same meaning
it
word.
Means avoid.
The four senses of this word going back in historical.
No.
Sense horrendous. One, avoid. Sense two, avoid. Sense three, avoid. Sense four, avoid.
Well done.
That is the only acceptable quatrain this Bible study teacher will accept. Yes, I like that. Now that reminds me of a quote. there's a Bible study book where a seminary prof, D.A. Carson, was asked something about, like, what's the most important part of Bible study? And he's like, the most important, there are three things that are essential for Bible study. Number one, read the text. Number two, read the text. And number three, read the text again. And I was like, oh, that was a...
I can remember as an intro to Bible student, way back in the dark ages before you even
back in the day, in the Disney,
and
we call that.
That was Dr. Cole would just say, three most important things to understanding every passage. Number one is the context. What is context? You know, understanding the grammar, the history, the author, what is his point? Number two, most important thing is the context. And what's the context? It's the language, the history, what the author's trying to say. And then number three is the context. And what's the context? It's the history, it's the grammar. And it's just, and it's context, context, context. Anyway.
Okay, we're going sideways, but now I have to talk. So Dr. Rathbun.
You guys are horrendous.
Dr. Rathbun preached in chapel a few weeks ago.
Yeah.
And if you can listen to it, it's really good. He went through the life of Joseph in one sermon, and it was one of those chapels where they did a lot of extra singing, so he only had like 20 minutes. And so he's like, I just wanted that. And he was talking about Joseph, and he's like, and that leads me to point number one. Life's not fair. And so, okay. And so he explains blah, blah, blah. And he's like, but it was all wrestling with the problem of evil. Like, how do you believe in a God when bad things happen? It was really good. And he's like, which leads me to my second point. Life's not fair. And we, none of us saw it coming, and his scarf was distracting us, and it was great. Yes. And I was like, okay, so these two are nice, not fair, because it is substantially the same thing. But then he's going to get to this part of the passage and it'll change. And I don't know why I thought that. Cause then he's like, and then that does lead me to my third point. Life's still not fair, and all four points were that. It was great. All four.
And this is the last digression.
Come
but you know that scene in Lord of the Rings where Théoden is like all weak and decrepit?
Yes.
And it's like, maybe your hand would remember its strength by gripping its sword.
Yes.
And I think of sometimes Dr. Ken, he's like kind of hidden away in his office, and he's working on all the academic stuff, and he, you know, and it's like, Ken, maybe your neck would remember its strength better if it gripped its scarf. Anyway, but
oh, that's good.
Horrendous. It's like his scarf is like his.
It's
that's
so
where
good.
He draws his wellness from.
It is. It's like it's his. It's Samson's
long
hair.
Let's move on. Let's keep going.
Okay.
So avoiding.
So when I looked the word up, the definition that my Greek dictionary gave me was to purposely. So this is not accidental. Purposely avoid associating with someone, and then one way of translating it might be turn away, and so. I tried to think, what does that look like? Because you can know you're supposed to do something, but sometimes it's too abstract and you don't catch that it's abstract when you hear it in like a sermon or something. So here are the questions I want us to bat around. Okay. Number one, how do you avoid these things? So here are people who claim to love God, have some sort of an appearance of godliness to the believers that Timothy is writing to, and yet they are unappeasable, slanderers, without self-control, brutal, not loving good, treacherous, reckless, swollen in conceit, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God, lovers of self, lovers of money, proud, arrogant. How do you avoid those people? So it's like a how question. Question number two, what do you avoid on this list? Do you avoid the people, or do you avoid the behaviors, but if you only see them in a person, or some of them are described as people who love things. So like you avoid certain people who love certain things. Number three, where and when might we encounter these things? And I think that one could be really profitable because we probably are right now thinking in our church body, which is true, but I'm thinking of a number of well-known media personalities in Christendom that maybe would be fair game. And then here's maybe the biggest question, and this might be the one just to spend all our time on. What does avoidance mean? Does it mean no contact ever? Or if it doesn't, then what would avoidance look like? Can you avoid something and be physically near it? Or does this mean I have to always separate myself? So I've got a couple illustrations and a thought, but I kind of want to just drop it on you two, hitting you cold with it and see, do you have thoughts? Do you, one of those, you answer any question you want. All of it's fair game.
So there's a lot of questions there. I don't want to take too much time because I think we could probably each talk 5 minutes on each of those questions. Yeah. I'm going to go with the first two. And so how do you avoid? And then, so it's hard when, and I'm going to put it in the context of church. It's hard when there's people in your church or in your spiritual orbit who seem like they ought to really be respected. And you watch, you know, the practice of their life. And when I say practice, I'm going to focusing on what we see. So you see their external practice and they have the appearance of what we would expect. But I'm sure everybody in their experience has a story or two where you can say the closer you got to someone, the more disappointed you got. And I would just say, so how do you avoid that? And I'm trying to come to a point in my life where, because I don't know. There's a mystery in godliness. There's things going on in someone's heart that I don't understand. I'll never see. But in the task of discipleship, you are to focus on the faithful. And so for me, what that looks like, how do I avoid? It's not necessarily actively avoiding, but it's looking for the people and relationships of virtue and prizing those.
Ding, ding, ding. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. To the point where I don't know if Tim's, but I have a Google Doc that I affectionately refer to as the one sheet to rule them all. Yeah, and there's two of them. I do it every year, and I started it last year. So, but there's a grid, and it's a grid of filtering the most important things, and the things of higher value trump the things of lower value. It's such a simple concept, but if there's something that's really buying for my time, I should be able to look at that grid and say, well, guess what? My family's more important than this, and my church is more important than that. But then when you get into talking about individuals, it's really hard because in one sense, you want to build up and speak truth to someone who's in error. I think the church is called to do that to one another. You know, when we think about church discipline, we usually think about like really big things. But what if it's like, hey, I'm just not sure you're really walking in the Spirit. Like, would you ever go to a guy one-on-one just for that? And then if they don't listen, like, hey, let's take another dude. Let's exhort this guy. Let's speak truth to one another. We're called to do that with everybody. But I do think for me, the balance of that, rather than starting on the, let's find all the people that I shouldn't spend time with, starting on the other side, which is let's think about the relationships and the spiritual influence that you really should be around and start there. And funny thing happens when you really start pursuing the things that are virtuous, other virtuous people pursue them too. Mm-hmm. And the unfaithful, I do think a lot of times it sifts itself out where the people you're to avoid, you simply avoid them by pursuing the things they don't want to pursue.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that is mostly, I think, an answer to question one, but kind of sifted into question two. But yeah.
I agree with everything you said there. I thought that was a really good answer. And questions one and I think it was like four are kind of similar. How do you avoid? And then what does void look like? So he kind of captures that idea, I think, in his question there. How do you treat these people? What does a void look like? You're just like walking on the other side of the street and you're totally avoiding them. I'm like, I don't think that's the answer. It's just, you know, these aren't your closest friends. They're people that you're going to be in the world around that are going to match this criteria. And you may have to work with them just because of the job that God providentially brought you to. And when you are seeking to smell like the aroma of Christ, okay, what do you smell like around these people?
Yeah.
If they're unbelievers, mm-hmm. you smell like death. So then what's going to happen? They're going to naturally not want to associate yep. with you either. Mm-hmm. And so you're going to kind of just start going on different paths. How do you treat them? Well, you would just be cordial and ask about the weather or talk about, I don't know, whatever is going on in your life. But as a generalization, your relationship's just going to be very superficial. I think that's what I got. What was your third question? I forgot that one.
Third question, and I didn't mean for them all to be answered, but I was trying to catch everything.
Yeah.
Where and when might you encounter these people?
Yeah, and that's what I kind of was talking about.
And I was thinking even as you were answering, and then as you started to talk, mm-hmm. I thought, really, we could like pick three contexts. And so like you've addressed the church one, mm. and you brought up work, and I was like, church, work, and then like either the dorm or like
neighbors.
Your what do you do? Like your friend group. What do you call the friend group? Your gang or your squad or whatever. And I think
your MySpace top five.
Yeah, that's it. That's it. Wow. But I think that might be worth considering. So here are some thoughts that I had. Sorry. So when you think about where you will encounter these kinds of, I'm going to call them wrong friendships. Okay. Wrong friendships. They can influence you. And I think the influence is the key thing here. I don't think it's the proximity.
Oh, that's good.
I think it's the influence. So I'm going to use the illustration of music in my own life, and I'll explain what I mean by that. In my 20s, my musical choices had some effect on me. They had some influence. But I would say when people have influence from culture, usually we think of the culture leads you away from a place to a place you never would have gone. It's like the thing that infects you. And I agree that that happens. But sometimes I think what it feels more like is my heart wants this thing and the culture is the echo chamber that lets me justify it. So when I would listen to my music, it did influence me in that I think it would maybe justify my desires and my interests and that sort of thing. It was more affirmative. So then what did I need to do to my musical choices? Because they would have, in a sense, been a wrong type of influence or a wrong friendship. I needed to avoid them, which meant I stopped listening to the kinds of music that were like that, which I think they were affirming my life, living choices, desires, things I wanted life to be like. Now, 20 some years later, when I pull up those same songs and I listen through them to see, hey, I remember I used to like this song. I wonder what I would think today. They don't have any, almost, I don't want to say none because I'm a human, but I would say they feel like they don't have any influence. So why is that? Well, I would say that what I do now is anytime I hear any music in a store or anywhere, I don't plug my ears and try not to hear it. I literally start thinking, what is the wording? What is the tone? What's it trying to do? How does the tone match the wording? Oh, what is this affirming? Like I'm thinking of all kinds. Tim, you and I talked about this once. Maybe you were here too.
Affect me.
And once you ask those questions, you take the influence out of the level of desire and you move it into the mind and it's just woefully inadequate. And so worldview analysis questions can often just like pop the bubble or throw a wet blanket on the fire or whatever. So I think if you, the listener, want to avoid wrong friendships, and think of that a little bit metaphorically, both actual people who influence you, but also any toward sort of a air quote friendship where there's influence coming into your life, I think you got two options, restriction or renewal, or we might say elimination or evaluation, or we might say evading or evaluate. I was trying to think of some quippy thing, but in one sense, you're like removing yourself from its sphere of influence. But in the second sense, and this one takes some maturity, I think, you might be in the sphere, but you analyze it, and by analyzing it, you show that it doesn't have good weight, and then it doesn't influence you as much. So that would be my opinion. if you have something in your life that's influencing you wrongly, don't jump to the evaluation yet. If it's hold power over you, get out from under it. Get away from it. Do the Joseph and flee the temptation. Okay? Don't sit there and stand in front of Potiphar's wife and try to debate sexual promiscuity with her. Okay? Get out of the house. But at the same time, talk to someone, learn to walk in the Spirit, and get to a point in your life where then you can be the one evaluating it. So that'd be the first path of discernment. The second path of discernment is to just pursue godliness. Pursue godliness. And this is just one verse. I'll read it. First Timothy 6:11. Paul is giving some, you know, commands, kind of machine gun form, to Timothy. And he says, "But as for you, O man of God, flee these things." He's talking about some sins, but he doesn't leave it at fleeing. He then immediately says, "Pursue righteousness, godliness, faith, love, steadfastness, gentleness." And so what does pursue mean? Looked it up, and it just means to pursue. Interestingly enough, it's dioko, which is also the word that we use for persecution. And that's where you're like following someone and persecuting them. But I'm not sure that that sense is carrying over here. But if that helps you remember that, it's just a pursuit word. So one of the things that you notice is if you see something, like there's this list of these problems, and he tells Timothy, flee these things. And they're very similar to what we just read in the 2 Timothy passage. You never just flee. You always flee to something else. And so now, what do? You pursue righteousness, godliness, faith, love. So I think this is the thing. Part of godliness is actively pursuing it. There's no passive sit back and wait. There's no let go and let God idea. Okay, God wants you to pursue this. And so I would say, what are some conclusions we can draw? How do you pursue godliness? Lots of good stuff to think about there. For the sake of time, though, I would say this. Many times, believers see a sin or a problem in their life, and they say, I've got to stop that. And they focus all their energy on removing themselves from the place and stopping. It's like the internet filter. And we would say, get that. Get that if you need that. It's accountability partner. We would say, get that. Okay? But that's half or a little less than half, maybe even only a third of the issue.
Right.
The real issue is, why are you pursuing that? And what should you be pursuing? And so how do you pursue godliness actively? That's the question I would ask.
Yeah. And I just, the thought that popped into my mind there, probably last year, 2024, the book that I read, that I thought was the most helpful in that kind of arena, mm-hmm. was that True Community by Bridges. Ooh. And he talks about, you know, yep. the person who, like, that whole, like, well, I'm just going to let God do it, you know, like, he's the one yep. that has to change mm-hmm. me. But then, like, someone who's, like, the active pursuant of obedience, but communing with the Lord and walking mm-hmm. in fellowship with him. But I also think that's why reading
yes.
good books yes. is so helpful, mm-hmm. even fiction. But so much of that is happening in the imagination of someone, like mm-hmm. to see and to pursue it within you. It's not just, you know, what your hands are doing, but it's what your mind is thinking and fixing on. And so, you know, to the exalting of, like, why would reading something like the Odyssey be helpful? You know, like having a story that captures a virtue that you are meditating and thinking upon in duration, how does reading that help you? Well, it's a pursuit of something very different than what you naturally want. Like, you know, we with Dr. Boyd a few weeks ago, we talked about reading Moby Dick, and it's like the old jalopy of a car, and, you know, yes. can't stay on the road, and it doesn't look super appealing, but there's a reason it's a classical work of literature. And if you dwell and you take the time, if you endure and pursue, that there's something in that that many people have found. And so just to exalt that in the pursuit of genuine godliness, reading of good books is a really helpful replacement for, you know, whatever it is that you should flee from.
Anytime you can renew your mind.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like you're, and it might not be easy. You're going to have to retrain those affections. So putting it off and then putting it on. And so then that accountability and a little thinklings group can really help you out.
So I think I would say that in my own life, when I've had issues with sins, the kind of sins that are besetting, life dominating, or at least the kind, there are life dominating sins that we don't notice because they just go unnoticed. Because they're not that big of a deal. There are life dominating ones that are super embarrassing. Okay. And usually we call those the life dominating. But in the times when I've had something that's taken a significant amount of my time and my life, and it's been a sin, and I've had long-term obedience away from it, it's always been the result of internal humbling, confessing that I love the wrong thing, and learning to trust God that He can give me much better, even if I never see it now. Like, I'm going to submit to God no matter what. That doesn't naturally result as a conclusion from, I've got to avoid a porn site, okay? I've got to avoid gossip. I've got to avoid overeating. Like, I've, whatever it is, you do avoid. You have to. Paul's literally saying, don't put those influences in your life. But the counter to that is that you have to love the right thing and pursue it, not pursue avoidance. That's going to, if you're pursuing avoidance, you're just pursuing staying away from something. This is pursuing the right thing. And so sometimes I think guys and gals, but guys especially in certain areas, they're pursuing avoidance, pursuing avoidance, pursuing avoidance. But then, like, if they don't sin that way in the day, they're like, hey, awesome, I'm good. But did you love the Lord? Did you follow Him? Is your whole life? In fact, some of these questions that are debatable where, man, can I play video games? Can I not? Can I do this? Can I not? Like, it's really hard for us to sort out until we switch the question and say, what is it that God wants me to do? Yeah. Does this actually help me? We were doing this in Christian Experience the other day. I lit up video games. And I was telling the guys, like, do anything. Become a carpenter. Like, learn about plumbing. Go lift heavy weights. Anything is going to help you better than video games. But the question is, yeah, but couldn't I do this for an hour a week? Well, what if I just did it a couple times? Okay, fine. All right. Switch the question around. What's your purpose in life? What does God want you to do? Yep. How does this contribute to that? And that's where it's like, there's no good return on investment, but unless you're asking the right question. So to me, it seems like those two things work really well. The last thing I'll say about pursuing is I want to go back to what you said. And then, well, do you guys have any other things you want to add?
I'll just one, you know, there's a couple good illustrations for it. And I'll kind of use the smell thing again. If something doesn't smell good.
Yep.
And your answer is, well, let's just put on another layer of clothes. So like if someone, like a junior high guy, he's at camp and he's running around getting super sweaty and it just smells. And it's like, hey, can you just put another t-shirt on? And it's like, oh, I still smell it. Can you put another t-shirt on? Or like, imagine you walk into your home and there's a garbage can full of trash and it smells. And you're like, well, let's just plug in another Glade, you know, refresher. And, you know, well, it still smells. Let's just plug in another Glade or, you know, let's get another Febreze. And you never actually go to the source of the smell. Like, you could put on every piece of clothing that kid owns, but if he never showers, he's still going to smell. And that's the, you could plug every plug-in in your home. You could have a Glade plug-in. If you don't take the trash out, you're not fixing the problem. And that's this discussion that we like to have of, yeah, you do need to obey, you know, you do need to go and avoid things. You need to pursue other things. But if you never really deal with the source of where that desire's at, you know, you are kind of just playing a game. And so all of those things are great, you know, but start in the heart. That'd be my last comment.
Yep. So I think I'll end on this. This will be the last little bit here that I want to end with. So listener, you need to, if you want to be godly, if you want to be godlike, if you want to be like an image bearer, if when you live, you want people to look at you and say, man, that person is very different. What, why? And you want it to be a form of godliness that's true and has power. There's no denying you have to avoid being influenced the wrong way. And honestly, that's going to hit your entertainment choices. It's going to hit your
positive choices, it's going to hit your time consumption choices, and it's going to hit your life direction choices. If you're really going to get down to it, it's going to hit your heart, like Charlie's saying. But then you don't just sit back and, oh, I haven't sinned, I'm okay. You get on mission. You put on your gun belt, you pick up your bullets as a soldier, and you go and you follow the Lord. You grab your plow, you get your seeds, you get in the field, and you start planting like the farmer in God's field. You live your life for the Lord. If you're not doing that, it won't work. And I really do think that to end this, highlighting the local church is very appropriate. So you said that thing about true community. Pastor Danny, well, this is weeks ago when he was doing a theology of community for like 4 or 5 weeks in between his current series on James. He was sharing that there are people who can attend church services, arrive, be there, leave, not engage with people, not be doing anything the rest of the week, not be getting into other people's lives, and they're, in that sense, actually forsaking the assembling of together. Because when Hebrews says, don't forsake the assembling, it's not just a proximity issue. Just like avoidance isn't proximity, it's get into the lives of other believers. So one easy way to pursue godliness is to be involved in the life of your church. Do you show up? Do you listen to the sermon and then jet out and you don't talk to anyone at church the rest of the week? Do you ask people how they're doing? Do you let people ask you how your life looks before the Lord? If someone does that, do you get offended at them that they would dare insert themselves in your life? Listen, friend, brother or sister in the Lord, that's not going to lead to godliness. That's going to lead to a form of godliness that has no power. So pursue godliness, avoid people who influence you in the wrong way, and get involved in your local church.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Thinklings Podcast. We would love to hear from you. If you have any feedback, suggestions, or potential topics that you'd like us to discuss, you can contact us through our email, thinklingspodcast@gmail.com. Remember, don't let this conversation end with this podcast. Read good books, talk about them with your friends, and always continue to cultivate your mind. See you next time on the Thinklings Podcast.